Joining me in the Catalyst Studios, Mr. Jeff Weaver. Welcome, sir.
Oh, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
We just finished a Tiger Bay lunch, and we talked about your new book, How Bernie Won, and I'm excited. I picked up a copy, and we'll definitely read it. Appreciate you signing it.
Well, I hope you enjoy it. It's some interesting stuff in there, from the early days of me with Bernie on the road in Vermont to the halls of Congress to the presidential campaign, and a little bit of look forward.
So I'd like to start today by talking about activism. Obviously, Bernie supporters are very active activists, and there are a lot of different ways to express activism, everything from, you know, signs and gatherings in the street all the way to people on the Supreme Court. And, you know, there's a lot of attention around Ruth Bader Ginsburg right now and the impact her life has had. And while we don't think of people on the Supreme Court as activists, they're clearly making an impact. And so, you know, as a young person, let's say, who's growing up and have a drive to make impact, how do you sort of parse out understanding where on that spectrum they may strategically want to place themselves?
Well, look, I think we need all of it, frankly. You know, if you look at the birth of our country, this was really a country born out of protests and activists. And, you know, even at that time, the sort of range that you're describing now existed back then, right? I mean, you had people in the streets. Frankly, at that time, you had British public officials being tarred and feathered, which, if you really think about having someone pouring hot tar over your body and then rolling you in feathers, is quite painful and extreme kind of a protest, not something I would advocate in modern America. But look, I do think we need it all. And I think the role that people, activists who are sort of in the streets with signs and what have you, provide is that they really raise awareness of the issues that they are trying to put forward. And I know sometimes the tactics make people uncomfortable, but as long as it's nonviolent, because I certainly do not advocate any kind of violence, as long as it's nonviolent, I do think that, you know, it is a fundamental American right. And fundamentally part of the sort of genes of our political culture in America, that there's always been protest from the very early days. The Boston Tea Party, obviously, was a big protest. And so I do think there's a role for all of it, frankly, as we go forward.
Certainly there's a role for all of it. But coming at it from the decision-making standpoint, if someone says, I'm X type of personality, or I want to make X kinds of change, then, you know, do you feel that one way precludes you from doing it another way? I mean, obviously, or a nation that pigeonholes, and so a picture holding a sign can be damaging if you try to go down the road and be the next Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I'm sure if people dug up old tape from Evening News in Boston in the mid-1986, they would see pictures of me being dragged out of the front of a police car at an anti-apartheid protest. And, you know, I've also been a House Chief of Staff, a Senate Chief of Staff, and, you know, run a presidential campaign. So I do think there is a time and a place for everything. And like I said, I think that people play different roles in the process, just like they do in politics or in business or in any other venture. And so I don't think that, you know, again, as people act in a nonviolent way, I think people understand that there are moments when we need to have protest in the streets in order to demonstrate to the rest of America, you know, some of the realities that are going on. Obviously, the Black Lives Matter movement, which is a wildly successful, you know, modern civil rights movement, engaged in that type of, you know, protest, including at some of our rallies during the 2016 primary process. And obviously, I'm not going to say that I was happy that we were getting a protest at one of our events, because we obviously were not, because we were trying to run a presidential campaign. But look, they were wildly successful in raising the issue of police violence in America to all communities. And the truth of the matter is now that there is a greater awareness in communities that are not affected by that type of activity of the situation in other communities.
Obviously, you're not a fan of our current president.
That's, I think, an understatement, but go ahead.
So one thing that's, you know, obviously unique about him is where you had, you know, Hillary mentions deplorables and she spends months trying to dig out from that. And Mitt Romney mentions the 47% thing that, you know, he got recorded secretly and he spends months trying to dig out of that. And Donald Trump says stuff that is, you know, more sort of controversial, we'll call it, than that. Yet, for whatever reason, it just, he rolls and rolls and rolls and rolls.
Right, including his most recent dumb Southerner comment, which he made about Attorney General Jeff Sessions, called him a dumb Southerner, which was, I think, many people in the South took great offense to.
So is there such a thing as a silver lining in this, where his presence has changed the nature of which politicians are allowed to communicate? You know, it seemed to be for a while that we were rolling where it was just avoid the gotcha, right?
Right. Oh, it still is. It still is, believe me.
But Bernie is a pretty free speaker, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And so how have you seen political communications change because of this Trump dynamic?
You know, Trump is an interesting phenomenon in American politics. But, you know, when I go around the country, and I, you know, obviously went around the country a lot in 2015 and 2016 and have since involved in politics and now the book tour and what have you, there was a real hunger in America for authenticity, right? But this is not really new. You know, if you look at polling back in 2004, when John Kerry was running against George W. Bush, you know, when you polled on the issues, people were much more aligned with John Kerry on the issues. But then when you asked the sort of famous, you know, who would you rather have a beer with question, you know, George W. Bush overwhelmingly won. And even if people didn't agree with George W. Bush, they felt he was more authentic, that he was saying what he felt, even if it wasn't exactly the position that the voter held. On the other hand, they felt Kerry was too removed or aloof or elitist in some cases. That was the sort of impression. I'm not validating it. I'm just saying that was what the impression that people had. And so people do want to feel like they're voting for somebody who is authentic. You know, what is ironic about Trump is that in many ways, he is the least authentic person we've had. He's clearly does say outrageous things and seems irreverent. But in truth, you know, he positioned himself as the sort of friend of the working men and women of this country. And his administration has largely, its policies have targeted those people from the very beginning when he tried to take health care away from tens of millions of people, to a tax bill, which is giving large sums of money to wealthy people at the expense of local communities and schools, you know, to the recent inability to give even a modest cost of living increase to federal employees. So on and on it goes. So it is funny that he is inauthentically authentic in an ironic kind of way.
You mentioned John Kerry, and he was dinged for being an elitist. And I read an article recently where America has by far the most words in his vocabulary that are derogatory towards intelligence, you know, nerd, geek, Poindexter, etc. Why do you think we have such a strain of anti-intellectualism in this country?
Look, the far right has always been a feature of far right politics, at least in the 20th century and into the 21st century, is sort of an anti-intellectual bias. And it's used as a way to sort of divide people up by convincing people that people who have education are somehow looked down on them or discriminating against them in some ways. And it's funny because it's an ethos that goes against what we have traditionally thought of in America as the thing you should do, right? You know, stories of people from humble roots who then go on to college or go into business or go into any kind of field who are then successful. This is sort of the American dream, right? That's the way we look at this country. And to the extent that that doesn't happen today, that people are barred from that kind of social and economic mobility, we view that as a negative. And, you know, that's part of what's driving campaigns like Gillum's and others, is sort of sense that people are locked into a caste system like you would be in like an aristocracy in Europe somewhere. But it's funny that the far right has always been anti-intellectual. You know, Trump once said, I love low information voters. And the truth is that the more information you have, the greater perspective you have on things, the less likely you are to support that kind of politics.
You know, obviously, we live in an age of scattered attention. And so low information voters, unfortunately, are more the norm than the exception. So just be interesting from a communication sort of inner working standpoint, knowing that it's the catchphrases and the marketing as much as the content. How do those conversations typically go when you try to present an idea?
It is important to try to convey the core of your idea in a very straightforward way, because, you know, I have been out of politics at various times in my adult life. And it's interesting from that perspective, because when you're in it, you know, every article that's written, even in an obscure place, or every web story or whatever that's obscure, that you're confident that everybody's reading it, everybody knows exactly what you're saying and every nuance of what you're saying. And look, politics competes with people's attention for legitimately for a million other things, like their work life, their family life, their, you know, hobbies and recreation, what have you. And so when you're speaking about political issues, I think it's very important to speak in a very straightforward way and not to have a lot of hemming and hawing and unnecessary nuance. And I also think that it gives voters a much clearer impression of who you are as a candidate, because in many cases, the policies you're advocating, you know, most people are not going to go out and read like long campaign pieces on taxes or this or that. But it does give people a sense of where you're at, you know, who you're looking out for. So that's very important to let people know whose side you're on.
But unfortunately, there are issues that are nuanced, right? And so that's the challenge.
No, that's right. So, you know, the idea is to convey the idea. You know, you're talking about communication. Obviously, you have to have a detailed policy on this issue or that issue. But in terms of communicating it, you need to sort of try to communicate the essence of what you are trying to deal with.
So a lot of times the filter between that policy and, you know, the well-documented piece of it and the message, the filter for that for people is the media. And the news is in the news a lot now. So what's your general impression of, you know, coming from wanting to put your information out there and when supporting Bernie? What was your experience with the media and your take on that?
So there is, look, it varies from place to place. Not, you know, I always hate to generalize, but we're sort of forced to. Our experience in 2016, you know, there was a pretty heavy media think, a group think that Bernie had no chance to win, that people may come out to his rallies but wouldn't come out to vote for him, all of which proved to be completely wrong. And there was a period in the fall of 2015 known as the Bernie blackout, you know, when Bernie got very little media attention, even though he was drawing huge crowds and getting more and more support among people in state after state. You know, the other thing that people forget about the media is the extent to which there is a business imperative, right? Almost all of these ventures are, you know, for profit or at least sort of operate in a normal sort of business environment. And they have to be at least self-sustaining, if not profitable. And that drives a lot of it. You know, there's been a lot of writing since the election about the amount of coverage that Trump got during the 2016 campaign process. And a lot of the criticism actually has come from other Republicans who felt that the media ignored them because they were covering Trump. I mean, I was at an event at Harvard after the 2016 race when they bring together all the campaign managers and senior staff of all the campaigns, so all the Democratic campaigns, all the Republican campaigns. And there were a lot of Republicans there because there had been a lot of Republican candidates. And the head of CNN, you know, who used to work with Trump on The Apprentice, was up there, and the Republicans were loudly screaming at them, like, you showed an empty podium, because when Trump was supposed to come out, they would go to the empty podium and wait till he came out, and they would cover the speech from end to end until he left. And there's valuable time on TV. You know, if Trump's empty podium's up there, you know, Marco Rubio's not up there, or Cruz is not up there, or what have you. And I think there was a real sense that, in that case, the business imperative of the media, because you never knew what Trump was going to say. It was bound to be outrageous. They didn't want to miss it because their competitors were all going to have it. So there was a sense that the business imperative really drove not the content of the coverage, but the choice about what was covered.
Well, I want to finish with understanding your personal fortitude. So you mentioned during the Tiger Bay lunch, there was a lady who had 60 Twitter accounts who was constantly attacking Bernie, and you were at the eye of a big storm, and there were a lot of emotions that ran high. And so knowing that there's this large portion of people who have this negative energy for you, how do you get out of bed each day? And you seem to be rolling hard and strong and flowing. So what's your philosophy on that?
They do call me the happy warrior. But look, you know, I have a great faith in democracy. I have a great faith in people. You know, our democracy is really a marketplace of ideas where I present some ideas. You may have different ideas. We can either talk about them. Maybe we come to consensus. Maybe we don't. Maybe we're on opposite sides on an issue. Then we go talk to other people and try to get more people to our side than to your side, and vice versa. And that's just the way it works. And I have great faith in that process, to tell you the truth, when it's done in a fair and open way. And, you know, I believe we, at the end of the day, end up with the best outcome for the country. So I am in a lot of, you know, debates with people or conflict with people. But at the same time, you know, I believe that politics is additive, and you want to bring more people to your side. It's not about, you know, a group of people who all have the sort of vanguard, you know, position on issues. I want to build the tent. And like I said, I have great faith in my fellow Americans that we'll build a better country.
Wonderful. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks for having me.